morning. May it please the court. This is a predicate. There were no drugs ever found in my client's house. But what we have here is a situation where the judge ruled in this matter based on substantial ex parte communications with the defense. She was presented documents and affidavits, none of which should have been under seal, none of which are confidential. Under the rulings of this court and any other court in the United States concerning the Freedom of Information Act, these documents would be releasable. However, what happened was, is in an ex parte hearing, the defendants were able to present their argument without rebuttal.
Suppose that the ex parte evidence had not been there. We're looking at this de novo. This came on summary judgment, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So we're looking at the record without that. What is your evidence that gets you past summary judgment motion? Forget the ex parte.
Okay, fine. The evidence, Your Honor, is very...
You have to win on the strength of your evidence, not the weakness of the government.
That's right. Our evidence is the government's evidence, or the defendant's evidence, which are the four documents that they presented to the judge. Only one of which is a really important document, and that is the property book entry. Because the property book is a separate entity, it's a book, you can't tear the pages out, you can't enter anything in. Once it's in there, it's in there. The interesting thing about that is the government claims that it's a bottom entry saying that this drug sale occurred on September 11th. However, the property book entry is July 11th. The property book entry says July 7th, 4 days earlier. It's very important. And that's clearly what it is because the property book entry has the criminal case number. And if you look on page 202 of the property book, it has the criminal case number that is used in the subsequent documents. So the police officers and the government and the defendants in this case have clearly lied because they claim that the sale took place on July 11th, when in fact the first entry is July 7th.
Well, but other documents have the case number on it too.
The other documents have the same case number as that entry.
The other documents referring to July 11th.
That's right. But they don't only refer to July 11th. The second document, which is the report of drug property collected, has two dates on it. One by Officer Ellingsworth on July 11th, or 3 days, I should say. But two other entries on that document are July 10th, by an officer Castor, and July 12th by an officer Whitfield. Again, we have a contradiction provided by the defendants themselves. On the third document, the only document, mind you, that has Ms. Smith's address on it, which is the evidence sheet which accompanies the rock of cocaine.
But the address on there is not inconsistent with any other information in any of the other documents.
I'm sorry.
The address is her address on that document.
That's her address.
And none of the other documents contradict that. They just don't have complete addresses.
The other documents say give an address of Northwest Washington, which is the way the police refer to a street sale because there's no address.
Well, but that's not inconsistent with the address of the house.
But you're saying... No. A reasonable juror could find. Anyway.
Well, the question is, it's going to be a credibility issue, which should go to the jury. The judge made a credibility decision about these defendants, which I believe she should not have made, because the documents that she was relying on, where they were saying that this sale occurred on July 11th, the first document shows it didn't occur on that day. It occurred on a different day. The evidence document that has her address on it never was submitted to the drug lab. That was finally conceded at near the end of the discovery, when all during discovery they refused to give it to us because they said it's the drug lab and we don't have it. And then In the last day of discovery, they said, oh, here it is, you can take a look at it. We never submitted it to the drug lab. That's the only document that has her address on it. It's a document that can be changed, recreated without any difficulty. The final document, which is the acceptance of the evidence accountability record, has July 10th on it. Again, a different date. The other aspect of this case is that the police regulations require unequivocally that all kinds of documents have to be created when they use a confidential informant. When you look at the appendix and what the police regulations say, none of this appears. They disappeared. They admit, the defense admits, that these documents were supposed to have been created. They say it should be in the working file, I guess, if it's not in the master file, but they can't find it. Now, they should have had it because Inspector Bray says we're supposed to keep those records. Secondly, we had notified the district that we were going to sue them within weeks of the search. So they were on notice to avoid spoliation of evidence. They should have seized the evidence and put it down. But that evidence is supposed to be kept because the prosecutors are supposed to use it in determining whether to take a case to court. And the evidence, if it ever existed, disappeared. But a jury could say, just as easily, it didn't exist because they were supposed to be there. When you look at the what those regulations say, the government says that they gave this informant money. And it's clear from the regulation that they must account for every penny of that. Lieutenant Avery in his deposition said so. Yet, no documents exist of any money being used in a drug sale concerning Ms. Smith's address. The absence of that evidence is circumstantial, but it is compelling in this case.
Claim for relief or cause of action, do you say survives the summary judgment motion?
First is our first cause of action, but it resurrects the actions of the conspiracy because the police officers in this case, we said, conspired before the search and after.
Stage, not judgment on the pleadings. What is your evidence that was before the court that there was a conspiracy?
Well, our evidence was that all the police officers submitted affidavits claiming a drug, or I shouldn't say all of them, several of them, they didn't agree. They implied that the drug sale occurred. Only Officer Ellingsworth in his affidavit says the drug sale occurred. The other officer...
I understand you have to succeed on the strength of your evidence.
Yes.
What is your evidence that a conspiracy existed?
That.
You just told me they didn't agree.
Here's one. We believe we can show that.
No, you can't. It's not what you can show. What have you shown?
Well, we've shown that, and it's kind of hard to say that, Your Honor, because it's ex parte.
Well, unless
they presented
ex parte,
a file.
Ex parte.
Okay.
That has nothing to do with the strength of your case.
The
ex parte at best goes to an argument of weakness in the defense case. You have to make your case against the summary judgment motion. So tell me what it is in your evidence that should have convinced the judge that there was a material issue, substantial issue of material fact, reference the existence of conspiracy.
One, the police said they were not familiar with the house. We presented evidence that they even had a roll call for a whole week in front of her house. They didn't like her because she was a gadfly. They didn't like her because she killed police to what they're supposed to be doing. So they knew exactly who she was, where she lived. So when they denied
evidence that there was a conspiracy?
Well, the conspiracy that's developed, Your Honor, is in that the file that these police officers presented to the court, which we say was the file of an informant, not the informant, has no record whatsoever of a drug sale at my client's house or references my client in any way. And that is very significant because they had to give that file. And why'd they give that file? It was 6 inches thick. It was the best file they had. This was an active informant, and the judge, in abundance of caution, does not want that person's name released. Why? Because he's a really good informant. But it has no, she did not talk to that informant. She didn't interview him. All she had was hearsay on hearsay that was the informant, but not one document connecting that informant to this case. And that is significant in the possibility of a conspiracy in this case by the police officers because they chose that file. Not one police officer who gave an affidavit said they talked to that informant. The only thing was Inspector Bray says, I talked to the handler of that informant who says he talked to Officer Ellingsworth who said that informant was being used. And that was all. Only evidence is a hearsay on hearsay that Officer Ellingsworth said that he used that informant to buy drugs at that house. Yet not one shred of evidence exists that a drug sale actually occurred. All the documents that should be there are not. And the police officers, why there's conspiracy? Because they all knew Sergeant Moy was supposed to know those documents were supposed to be, because he's supposed to sign them. The other inspectors, the other supervisors were supposed to sign it. Lieutenant Avery says, I should have that file, and I don't. That's why there's a conspiracy. But clearly, it's all based on our first cause of action, is that Officer Ellingsworth lied in his affidavit. Because his affidavit is so weak, he doesn't describe who the drug seller is.
I think I have an answer to my question.
Okay. And that's what it is.
Thank you. Would you like to save the rest for rebuttal?
Yes.
All right. Counsel for appellees.
May it please the court, I'm James McKay, and I represent the District of Columbia defendants. The district's motion for summary judgment was supported by Officer Ellingsworth's affidavit, which described in detail, based on personal observations, the controlled drug buy by the confidential informant on Leola Smith's residence on July 11, 2007. And now this shifted the burden under Rule 56E to the plaintiffs to present affirmative evidence to establish the existence of a material fact. If the only evidence that she produces is evidence that a police inspector could not find the working file for the confidential informant, which is different from the master file, which he did have, and this is not sufficient. The jury would have to speculate that the mere fact that an inspector couldn't find a file meant that the whole thing was a fabrication. I think that just too many logical leaps. It's just not sufficient. The evidence shows that he did find the existence of the confidential informant was established. He found the master file that detailed the numerous times
that he was missing records, right? You agree there's missing records. I mean, there is stuff missing here, right?
I'm sorry.
There are missing records here, aren't there?
They could not find the working file for the informant. Now, I have to say, Ms. Smith points to MPD procedures. Of course, they only apply if the evidence is going to be used in a criminal prosecution, and there were no arrests here, so there's no criminal prosecution. And those normal rules that he pointed to wouldn't apply. But in any case, we certainly there was only a single copy. It could not be duplicated. It was hard copy, and it was just at the time that Inspector Bray was deposed, he couldn't find that working file. But there was plenty of other evidence that the controlled drug buy did occur.
But what about, so your position is that there was no obligation to maintain these records?
Well, I think there was an obligation, but the failure to find the record was not sufficient evidence.
I understand. I just wanted to find out whether you.
No, we definitely have an obligation, yeah. But the issue here is whether or not.
I understand that.
Officer Ellingsworth made the whole thing up. The evidence, he doesn't dispute the fact that he had very considerable experience in arresting people for drug offenses. And the fact of the drug buy was corroborated by the documents that were produced to plaintiff's counsel, and he was shown the originals. And the number three makes it clear. It's the only date there is July 11th, which was the date of the controlled drug buy, and it has the precise address of Leo Smith's residence on it. And it the evidence shows that they obtained a white powder substance that tested field positive for cocaine, and that corroborated Officer Ellingsworth's affidavit. We submit, we think that Officer Ellingsworth's affidavit is sufficient to support the motion for a summary judgment.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part.
I'm sorry, we submit that Officer Ellingsworth's affidavit is sufficient to support the motion for summary judgment, and that you don't need to go to the routine records, which were produced at the plaintiff's counsel, which are in our confidential supplemental appendix. But that should be enough. And of course, there's more. There's even further, very specific corroboration in the ex parte declarations filed by the supervising officers. Now, the plaintiff's counsel in both his briefs says, well, these declarants had a vital stake in the outcome of this case, but none of them were defendants. None of them had anything to do, whatever, with the controlled drug buy or the search of Leo Smith's residence. The officers Avery, Bray, and Gray, they were really out of the chain of command, so they were independent. They had no vital stakes. They just provided this information, ordered to do so by the district court. The district court ordered the district to go out and talk to the informant and bring back declarations. And we followed the district court's instructions. There were no, as far as I know, the only hearing was open to all parties. The plaintiff's counsel was there. It was on, I think, November 23rd, 2010, and it's in the record. There was nothing secret.
Is the district's position that the evidence arising from the absence of records that are required to be maintained does not give rise to an inference in the plaintiff's favor?
Well, number two answers, Your Honor. First, the requirements only pertain if the evidence is going to be used in a criminal prosecution,
well,
which
but
wasn't.
You answered Judge Tatel's question by saying that there was an obligation to maintain the records. I thought that was.
Well, there's a general, clearly a general ministerial procedural obligation. I mean, I'm not saying there's any regulation that says we have to do that. But obviously, it's a matter of normal routine and just efficiency of operating
what about
the office.
The answer to my question.
Well, the answer is there's a general obligation to keep your records. There's no particular regulation that says you have to do it for a specific reason, but we clearly have to keep track of our records.
It's her case, as I understand.
Pardon me?
Here is her case. You have this one officer who says there was a confidential drug buy at her house on a certain date, and drugs were recovered.
Yes.
And there's no record to show that.
Well,
and that the records are lost, misplaced, whatever.
But there is a record, a routine record. It was our exhibit number 3 to our confidential supplemental appendix is a routine record that has her address on it. It has the date on it. It has the name of the confidential informant redacted, but it has all the information that substantiates the fact of the drug buy, and it is a routine record that was presented in evidence and shown to the plaintiff's counsel. So
I had one other question.
Oh, can I just follow that up? But I think what Judge Rogers was asking you was, I mean, what you just described, that document, might be an answer to the presumption that flows from having lost the documents. But her question was, why, setting aside these other documents, why can't the absence of documents that you concede the city was supposed to keep can't be a basis for assuming that making some assumptions about their absence.
Your Honor, but it doesn't. It certainly wouldn't go as far as to be evidence of a fabrication by an officer of the existence of an informant and the occurrence.
Just enough to get them to the jury. That's all. That's all we're talking about. Just enough to get them to the jury.
Well, no, I don't think the jury would have to speculate that the records are lost or misplaced for numerous reasons that have nothing to do. There's no allegation that there was an intentional act to conceal the record, none at all. It was just, at most, there was an inference that a little negligence there, we couldn't find the record. But it doesn't go as far as to permit the jury to infer that there was an affirmative attempt to fabricate the whole existence of the confidential informant and fabricate the occurrence of the drug buy. That just is too far a logical leap.
Their only point is that the absence of records on the confidential informant can be at least evidence on the plaintiff's side that there was no confidential informant. Now, there may be other evidence that counters that, but that's the only question I think Judge Rogers was asking.
Well, it is evidence, but it is not sufficient to meet the burden of producing affirmative evidence that would allow a jury to decide that the there was credence to the allegation that Officer Ellington fabricated the whole thing. The evidence in this case was so one-sided, to quote Supreme Court and Anderson v. Liberty Lobby, that the defendants were entitled to summary judgment. It was just overwhelming. And as I said, there are several levels. We feel that it's our first position that the affidavit of Officer Ellinger was sufficient and that the evidence presented that Inspector Bray couldn't find this particular document was not sufficient to rebut that. But then you could go further and look at the fact, especially confidential exhibit number 3, that clearly substantiates a drug buy at that date, at that place, and it totally substantiates independently of a routine record, Officer Ellingsworth's affidavit.
Does she get the benefit of any inference by the fact that this was not a single family house and that the drugs were found in one of the basement apartments?
Well, no drugs were found in the search of the house. I don't think that issue is certainly not an issue that has been raised by Leola Smith in this appeal, the fact that there were multiple apartments. The only argument presented to this court in appeal is the argument that the whole thing was fabricated, that there was no confidential informant, there was no drug deal. Officer Ellingsworth, for some unknown reason, there's no motivation shown here, made up the whole thing, and everybody else conspired. Now, there's no evidence of that. The fact that a inspector could not find a record is not evidence of an intent to commit a very serious crime to fabricate the existence of a confidential informant and fabricate the existence of a drug buyer.
Conspire to do so.
Pardon me?
And conspire to do so.
Conspire to do so. So all this thing is the jury would have to be speculating all over the place to get that conclusion. It's just not enough to create a jury issue. It's not sufficient. Of course, as a third course stop, and I don't think this court needs to look at the or or rely upon the declarations that were submitted ex parte, but they make it even clearer, crystal clear, that there was a specific confidential informant who participated in this drug buy at this date in this residence.
And therefore, get into that, or if we get into that, we open another issue.
Yes.
Well, the question. If we don't get into this.
Well, Your Honor, we do not think that the court needs to get there, but of course there is a well-established informant's privilege, and here we're talking about a civil case. We're not talking about a Riviera situation where the whole conviction depended upon what an informant says. We're only talking about something that was one of the three declarants said, and they could be deposed. In fact, Inspector Bray was at a hearing. You could be cross-examined. So it's not anything close to a situation in which the balancing test, under which the district court has broad discretion, everybody admits that, the court has broad discretion. There's nothing here that would tip it the other way to require the discovery of the identity of a confidential informant who may, you know, his life may depend upon his keeping his
identity. So you have a case where you have an officer who claims he made he saw a confidential informant enter this house on a certain day, and that drugs were recovered.
Yes, Your Honor.
That, you say, is enough, and that the plaintiff cannot get the benefit of necessary inferences from the absence of evidence sufficient to show a material issue of disputed fact.
Well, Your Honor, the affidavit says, I know this confidential informant, we use it a lot, and he has been reliable.
I don't think the issue anymore is the existence of the confidential informant.
Of course, that was the issue, his main issue below, but on appeal.
He raised the other one below, too, according to the district.
Right, he did, but as far as whether the drug buy occurred, the fact there isn't one, we can't find the working file. That's one piece of evidence, but there's the other evidence, the documentation, the routine record of number three of our confidential supplemental appendix that says the precise address, the precise date, and the fact that you've got crack cocaine, testing field positive for cocaine. You've got all that in the
so
confidential.
In order for the district to overcome her evidence arising from this absence of records that are required to be maintained and cannot be found, the district has to rely on document number three?
Your Honor, we don't think that this court needs to rely upon that. It's our position that the mere fact that Officer Bray could not find the working file was not sufficient to create a jury question as to the one issue that is presented to this court, the issue whether Officer Ellingsworth fabricated the affidavit, that he lied under oath in the affidavit he presented to the Superior Court judge, and that the whole incident never happened. That is the mere fact that you can't find records, and records are lost for numerous reasons. There's no allegation of any intent here. At the moment, it's negligence. And that is not enough to create a jury issue as to the question whether the whole thing was fabricated. But if this court needs to go further, the court under Rule 56C3 can rely upon the entire record. And in this case, the court could look at the confidential supplemental exhibits that we that the routine MPD records that document the occurrence of the drug sale, and looking at that, putting aside the confidential informant, so there certainly was some sort of drug sale that occurred the evening of July 11, 2007. So we submit, Your Honor, that the district court was correct in granting summary judgment to the defendants on this issue of whether or not the affidavit was, insufficient, whether the whole thing was fabricated, and that the evidence that the plaintiff presented was not sufficient to meet the plaintiff's burden that was shifted to her to defeat summary judgment. Therefore, we would ask this court to affirm the district court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant.
First off, I would mention that Exhibit 3 of the evidence docket does not have any redaction of the informant's name. There's no place for the informant's name to be on that document. So there's no document connecting this drug sale to any informant, and clearly not to this case. The government, or the defense, is putting on that the police are sloppy. However, Inspector Bray doesn't say that, nor does Lieutenant Avery. In fact, they say the opposite. They're not sloppy, they keep records. And the government's position is that, oh, we're sloppy, we don't keep records. That's not true. The case in this situation, and it's not speculative for a jury to determine that the absence of records has significance, especially in this case where only one officer, Officer Ellingsworth, says that this drug sale occurred.
Does that get you to the jury all by itself?
Well, the jury heard part of this case, Your Honor.
The missing document all by itself, does that get you to the jury?
We're not going only on the missing document.
What else is it you're going on?
We are going on.
That's what I was asking you during your argument in chief and not getting an answer to. We're back to that.
We're going on these four documents because the officer Ellingsworth says it occurred on the 11th. The property book entry says it occurred on the 7th. Two of the documents have the date of July 10th. So only one document has only the 11th on it. And the question is Officer Ellingsworth telling the truth that a sale occurred on the 11th when his entry on the property book has the 7th of July? He is in contradiction, not only in that, but also in his affidavit. He says he saw an address, 1812 9th Street, in his affidavit. Well, the evidence was it had 181. There was no 2. At that time, the 2 was missing from the address. So when he said he saw that number, he was not telling the truth. So there is solid evidence that a jury can infer that this officer is lying. And it's not new. It's not unique.
Assume just that he's lying, that a jury could find.
The jury could find.
Does that get you there on what counts?
On count one, at least.
The conspiracy?
No. The initial count that he filed a false affidavit. Okay. Just count one. The conspiracy one.
Any other? Now, you have, what, 6 counts in here?
What's that?
How many counts did you have in your complaint?
We had 7, Your Honor.
7 counts, okay.
Now, one count
that
went to the jury.
On anything beyond count one.
What's that?
Does that get you there on anything beyond count one?
It may resurrect the destruction of property, Your Honor, on that case. Now, the jury took the case of Mr. Franklin and awarded him $28,000, finding that the police officers were not truthful. And
was there a specific interrogatory to that effect, that the police officers were not truthful?
Well, the only way they could do that was on there was no real documentary evidence submitted in that trial. It was only testimony of the police officers and Mr. Franklin. And Mr. Franklin provided a...
I'm sorry I pursued that. It really doesn't matter what they found.
But he did present a map or diagram of his apartment, and the jury found that the police officers claiming that they wouldn't know it was a separate apartment in a brownstone.
It really doesn't matter what they found in the other case.
But they awarded him $28,000. In this case...
Really, does it matter if they awarded him $28,000?
Well,
I mean,
it was an insignificant number. And they found...
You can't lay that file down and say this case is wrong because that case went a different way.
Well, they found a Fourth Amendment violation, and in this case is a Fourth Amendment case. And the interesting about this case that's important about the Fourth Amendment is that, as they point out, that almost all the Fourth Amendment cases are criminal cases. But what happens in this case where there is no evidence found? Does the Fourth Amendment no longer exist? Because the police officers can then make up anything, go there, and if they're lucky, they find something. If they don't lucky, they don't
find
it.
That's the inherent problem with the exclusionary remedy. It only protects in those cases where incriminating evidence was found.
That's right. But this is not a unique case. We've showed that in Atlanta, Georgia, they did this. The police there did the same thing. They claimed a confidential informant went to a house and they killed the woman. Now, they didn't kill anybody here because Ms. Smith was not there. But it could have happened.
They would have killed her.
It's a dangerous issue.
I've got enough response.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll take care of everything. All right. Nice work with you, too. Thank you. Bye-bye.